Okay, well, since there's so little controversy around, I thought I would cover a controversial topic today. It has nothing whatsoever to do with the current controversies that are taking place. It's probably my least favorite topic of all times. I never thought I would actually get into it, but I am going to. But don't worry, it's not going to be technical, because I'm technologically challenged when it comes to the subject. It has to do with some aspect of the holy days. What do you suppose that is? Anybody have any guesses? Anything controversial about the holy days? Calendar. The calendar. Oh, yes, you got it right. So even though summer is still on, obviously we're still planning for this year's feast, and it's don't anybody tell me how close it is. I don't want to hear it, because it's closer than I would like to admit. Now, seriously, everything is going pretty well as far as I know. We've got the speaking schedule done, and pretty much have our department heads figured out, and everything is looking good so far. So anyway, the topic for today is talking about the calendar. I've never covered this subject before that I can recall for a number of reasons, but we're going to talk about it today. So what, first of all, are the basics of the calendar? How do we determine when to keep the holy days? And how do we know who or what to believe on the subject? Some of you have probably seen more of this than others have, but there are all sorts of ideas about the calendar. There are people who meet with us, maybe even card-carrying United members that believe in a different calendar. So how do we know? How do we know who's right? That's what we're going to talk about here today, and how we determine what calendar to follow. Let's go to Leviticus chapter 23 here, first of all. It talks about the holy days and festivals. Leviticus 23, we'll start in verse 1. Very familiar territory, obviously. The Lord spoke to Moses, saying, "Speak to the children of Israel and say to them, the feasts of the Lord, which you shall proclaim to be holy convocations, these are my feasts. 6 days shall work be done, but 7 days is a Sabbath of solemn rest, a holy convocation. You shall do no work on it. It's the Sabbath of the Lord in all your dwellings. These are the feasts of the Lord, holy convocations, which you shall proclaim at their appointed times." Very familiar territory. The word translated appointed times, and also the one translated feasts, believe it or not, is a Hebrew word, moed, M-O-E-D. Plural is moedim, M-O-E-D-I-M. I-M is the plural ending in Hebrew. This word can mean also appointed times. The word seasons is misleading in the King James. It doesn't have anything to do in that sense with seasons as we think of the term. It's appointed times or feasts. The New Revised Version translates it this way. It says, "These are the appointed festivals of the Lord, which you shall proclaim as holy convocations, my appointed festivals." And likewise in verse 4, "These are the appointed festivals of the Lord, the holy convocations which you shall celebrate at the time appointed." And that is Moedim, time appointed there as well, for them. The Tanakh, Jewish version, says, "These are my fixed times, the fixed times of the Lord, which you shall proclaim as sacred occasions." And verse 4, "These are the set times of the Lord, the sacred occasions which you shall celebrate, each at its appointed time." So again, Moedim is translated as appointed times. Of course, we know what those times are, what those days are. Verses 5 and 6 talk about the 14th day of the month at twilight is the Lord's Passover, and the 15th day of the same month is the Feast of Unleavened Bread to the Lord. In verse 24, it mentions the 7th month, the first day of the month, is a time of memorial blowing of trumpets, holy convocation. Verse 27, also the 10th month, the 10th day, sorry, the 7th month, so it'll be the Day of Atonement. And of course, verses 32 through 34 talk about the, also about Day of Atonement. "It shall be to you a Sabbath of solemn rest, and you shall afflict your souls on the 9th day of the month at evening. From evening to evening, you shall celebrate your Sabbath," speaking of the Day of Atonement. And again, in verse 34 here, talking about the Feast of Tabernacles, "The 15th day of the 7th month shall be the Feast of Tabernacles for 7 days to the Lord." So there are specific appointed times listed here in terms of which day of the month. So far, so good. But it doesn't give us a calendar. Prince, that's a little bit of a problem, right? It says which day of the month it is, but we don't have the calendar. Now, of course, this was written by Moses to the nation of Israel, and they obviously knew which he was talking about. Just as today, we know from our Roman calendar what days we say that, you know, the date today in the month of August, August 6th, 7th, whatever it is, 7th, right? Anyway, we would know, most of us, myself accepted, I guess, what we're talking about. But and, of course, they knew at that time, but we don't know today. And, of course, there are several different versions as to which calendar should be followed. I'd like to go to Genesis 1 and verse 14, which gives us some indication here of something that's important in terms of the calendar, the basic fundamental principle of the calculating calendar. Genesis 1 and verse 14 in the chapter that talks about the recreation after the destruction brought about by Lucifer's rebellion. Verse 14 in the New King James says that then God said, "Let there be lights in the firmament of the heavens to divide the day from the night, and let them be for signs and seasons and for days and years." Now, of course, we pretty well know what those lights are. The light during the day is what we call the sun. That's pretty clear. And the moon would be the one that gives us light at night. We don't have to speculate on that either, because in Psalm 136, verse 7, it actually identifies, or actually 7 through 9, identifies the great lights as being the sun and moon. Psalm 136 and verses 7 through 9. This is a praise to God here, and says, "To him who made great lights," in fact, it's one of the hymns that we sing, "for his mercy endures forever." And notice verse 8 of Psalm 136, "The sun to rule the day, for his mercy endures forever. The moon and stars to rule by night, for his mercy endures forever." And obviously, you know, we read there in Genesis 1, verse 14, that these are to determine the days and to divide the day and the night and let them be for signs, seasons, for days and years. Days, as we all know, are determined by the sun. So far, this is so basic and simple, its verges probably be unboring. Daytime is when the sun gives us light. Nighttime is when the moon and stars give their light. I mean, everybody's with me so far, right? This is pretty simple. Okay, so Genesis 1, verse 5, also a very rudimentary, basic, simple, something we all understand, we'd all agree with. Genesis 1, verse 5 says, "God called the light day, and the darkness he called night." Okay, we still follow that custom today. So the evening and morning were the first day. Day and night are easily determined by observation, aren't they? We all know when it gets dark, it's night. When the sun comes up, it's daytime. Okay, very clear. No argument whatsoever. Jesus said in John 11, verse 9, in fact, again from the Bible, so we don't even have to guess at it, he said, "Are there not 12 hours in the day?" And that's astronomically true, although technically it's true in exact measure only twice a year. Does anybody know when those times are? What they're called in our astronomy and calendar? Yeah, equinox? Yes. The equinox, which happens twice a year, and the word equinox actually comes from two Latin words, which mean equal night. So is the day and night are both 12 hours at that particular time. The rest of the year, it varies some. You know, my wife and I have different viewpoints on the equinox. She gets discouraged when the days start getting shorter. I say, hey, summer is just starting. It's the first day of summer. So you can determine which is the pessimist, which is the optimist. I guess I'm the optimist in the summer, and she's the optimist in the winter, when the first day of winter is when the days start getting longer. She gets all excited, and I think, oh, man, winter's just starting. You know. So anyway, that's one of our little differences there. But so those two times a year, the days and nights are exactly 12 hours. The rest of the year, of course, it varies a little bit. The weekly cycle of 7 days is also easy to determine because it's simply a period of 7 24-hour periods of time based on the setting of the sun. The time order of days has never been changed from the beginning. And one way, easiest way to prove that is the fact that Jesus kept the Sabbath on the same day the Jews did, right? And you can actually get online and Google calendar and put in, say, 31 A.D., and it'll bring up a calendar, and you'll find out 7th day is what we call Saturday day. No problem, okay? I don't think anybody, any Sabbath keepers, are arguing that there's a different day that's the Sabbath. We're all in agreement so far. We know how to determine days. We know how to determine weeks. We know which day the Sabbath is. Days, all that, weeks, those are all very, very clear. All right. Now, there is one little thing you may or may not be aware of. I think I've mentioned it before, though, and that is that there is a question regarding when the Sabbath day ends, begins, and ends. You do it at sunset or darkness. And actually, the Bible doesn't tell us. You know, I learned that the hard way. I never forgot it. Many, many years ago, there was a new couple that was attending church, and they'd done their homework, and they said, why do we keep the Sabbath from sundown to sundown? I said, well, there are a lot of places in the Bible that tell us that. And they said, well, where? And I said, well, I don't know. I'll go home and check it out and get back to you. Still looking. The only place that gives it and doesn't really say either one there even is on the Day of Atonement. Remember we read that? It says from evening to evening. But it says evening to evening. It doesn't say sunset to sunset or darkness to darkness. It says evening to evening. All right, so we figure it from sunset to sunset. And, you may not have known that, but it doesn't really say for sure. So that's the closest thing there is to, let's say, a controversy with regard to the Sabbath. I don't think people argue over that. I've never heard people fight over is it sunset or darkness that determines the day. But anyway, that's one thing that's really not determined. Other than that, Sabbath is very clear because it's based on days, and days are determined by the sun. Okay, the sun comes up, sun goes down, day, night, very simple. Okay, now we have the holy days, which were instituted on specific days of the 1st and 7th months. Let's go back to Genesis 1:14 again, because that's a very significant passage with regard to the subject. Genesis 1, verse 14, the key word in here is the word translated seasons. That word also is moedim in Hebrew. God said, let there be lights in the firmament of the heavens to divide the day from the night. Let them be for signs and seasons, moedim, and for days and years. The New Jewish Bible translates it this way. God said, let there be lights in the vault of heaven to divide the day from night, and let them indicate festivals, days, and years. There are some people believe that's the way that should be translated, that God mainly created set in motion again the sun and moon, put them back into the proper orbit and such to where the holy days would be determined by that basis. They think that's the main meaning of this verse. Well, it may or may not be the main meaning, but certainly is one of the meanings of this particular word in this context. Another translation says, then God said, let there be lights in the expanse of the sky to separate the day from the night. They will serve as signs for festivals and for days and years. Okay, now, with regard to the calendars, the Hebrew calendar is a lunar calendar. Okay? So each month begins with a new moon. Now, that seems pretty simple as well. Psalm 81, verse 3 talks about the new moons and what was done on that particular occasion. Psalm 81 and verse 3 says, blow the trumpet at the time of the new moon, at the full moon on our solemn feast day. So the trumpet was blown at the time when the month began, and the new moon was also blown mid-month at the full moon, which is the 15th day. which is a feast day. Obviously, if you've got a new moon at the beginning of the month, halfway through the month, it's going to be a full moon. And then it goes from there. So, once again, in the Tanakh version, it says, blow the horn on the new moon and on the full moon for our feast day. The first day of the month was at the time of the new moon. Also, the Feast of Trumpets, of course, is a new moon. And the technical term for the Feast of Trumpets is called the Molad of Tishri. Okay, the Molad is the time when the conjunction of the sun and moon came together. And this took place on the seventh month, the first day, and that was the first day then of the Hebrew calendar. So another New English translation says, blow the ram's horn on the day of the new moon, and on the day of the full moon when our festival begins. Tanakh says again, blow the horn on the new moon and the full moon for our feast day. So again, it sounds pretty simple, doesn't it? New moon, first of the month, 15th of the month, full moon. Okay, pretty easy. However, although months are determined by the moon, what determines the seasons? The moon or what? I mean, what accounts for the differences in seasons? The sun. And the earth, you know, as far as the earth in conjunction with the sun. Doesn't have anything to do with the moon. All right? So, even though the festivals were designated to be observed on specific days of specific months, they are also connected with what in Old Testament Israel? The harvest season. So, since there are the days actually run off in terms of a month is approximately 30 days in length, okay, the average length. But there are approximately 365 days in a year. So what does that tell you? 30 days in a month. How many months in a year? 12. So how many lunar days are there in a lunar calendar? 360. But they're actually astronomically 365 days. So you got a problem there of 5 days. So if something weren't done over a period of time, pretty soon it would run way off. It'd be like probably your wristwatch if you didn't reset it every so often. You know, it loses time or gains time or whatever. So already now we've got a problem. So how do we deal with that? So what do we do? All right, we have a study paper that is available on the members' website on the Hebrew calendar. It's a doctoral paper approved by the Council of Elders. There are other problems with regard to the calendar. Let me just quote here from the study paper. So we begin by pointing out the complexities of the problem. We must take into account the following factors. Number one, the Bible does not provide us with the complete means for calculating a calendar. There are also no calculations provided in the scriptures. The Bible clearly indicates that there were the components of a calendar in existence almost from the beginning. Hours, days, months, seasons, and years are all mentioned. These are the essential elements of any calendar. Number two, most calendars that are being proposed use the new moon as the beginning of the month. While we would not disagree with this principle, we know of no definite biblical statement to that effect. We accept the new moon as the beginning of the month, and there are references in the Bible which indicate that the new moon was the beginning of the month, but we know of no clear statement that the calendar is to be calculated on this basis. Now, we believe it should be, but you can't really just totally nail it down and prove it. Number three, the Bible does not define the term new moon. Today, we can determine the new moon by mathematical calculation. Visual sighting was one of the methods used in the past. With visual sighting, what are you looking for? The exact conjunction of the astronomical new moon is not visible. The Bible really does not answer this question. Most so-called sacred calendars use Jerusalem time as a standard for calculation. So that's another thing. I mean, which new moon you go by? Where you live, or Jerusalem, or where? Okay, those are questions that the Bible doesn't really answer. When God gave the holy days to Israel, they were not in the land of Judah. What city was used in the book of Exodus for the frame of reference? None is identified. Where is the authority for choosing Jerusalem? The concept was applied by the Jews, but it's not found in Scripture. Number four, the vernal equinox is referred to as the first day of spring. This is virtually universal in the various calendars. There's no statement in the Bible to this effect. Most calendars also assure that Passover must always fall after this vernal equinox. Again, the Bible's silent on this subject. Number five, the Bible tells us the month of Abib is to be the beginning of months. The term Abib means ears or green ears of grain in Hebrew. Abib must be in the spring of the year. This requires the periodic addition of a 13th month to prevent Abib from occurring in the middle of the winter instead of spring. So see, that's what they do in the Hebrew calendar. Every so often they add a 13th month. Now, we're all familiar with leap year, right? We have 29 days in February. But the Hebrew calendar runs off even more, and so they have to add actually a whole month. It's called an intercalary month that's added periodically to adjust the calendar to the harvest season. Okay? But nowhere in the Bible does it say to do that. So obviously some people have different ideas. The point of all this, it says, is very simple. Every calendar is based upon some assumptions. While we can argue that some of these assumptions make more sense than others, we cannot argue the point of a pure biblical calendar. The question really comes down to, which calendar will we accept? The one preserved by the Jews for at least 1,500 years, or one devised by others? That's really what it gets down to. The United Church of God has chosen to accept the Hebrew calendars preserved by the Jews. We have embarked on a study of the calendar and are reviewing submitted papers. At this point in time, we have not seen enough evidence to cause us to reject the currently accepted Hebrew calendar. So, being on the doctrinal advisory team, every so often, another paper comes in about the calendar. I always say the same thing. I basically just say, I'm calendar challenged. I can't add anything in the subject here. So, you know, that's different ideas different people have, but that's the official position of the United Church of God. All right, so let's carry it forward here, because there are other matters of concern regarding the times of the holy days in connection with the weekly Sabbath, which brings up one of perhaps the main controversy regarding the calendar. Anybody know what that one is? If you don't, good for you. Ever heard postponements? You haven't? Okay, maybe some haven't. Right, well, let me tell you a little bit about those. So now we're getting so technical, it's getting boring, right? We had to study this in Ambassador College, and I've said before, the main thing I learned in the class is an appreciation for people to understand how to calculate the calendar, because it's very, very complicated. This makes it, I think, fairly simple, though, comparatively speaking. So in the study paper, again on page 4, it says, most of the controversy seems to revolve around the rules of postponement. The calendar is set, and the holy day is determined by the Molad, which again is a conjunction of the sun, moon, and earth, of Tishri, the seventh month in the Hebrew calendar. The time between the first of Tishri and the first of Abib is 177 days. I bet you didn't know that. Right? In order for the holy days to be kept in their seasons, intercalary months must be added approximately every 3 years in a 19-year time cycle. We talked about that already. The Hebrew calendar also employs rules of postponement for establishing the first of Tishri. Since all holy days are calculated from this point, some have questioned the use of these rules. So this is where a lot of the controversy comes in. Some people say, well, they have no authority to do this. Well, you know, there is nothing said in the Bible about the calendar, so it's a question of who you want to follow. Do you want to follow what they do, or some other person thinks they have a better idea? There are four simple, you may disagree with that term, rules of postponement for the Hebrew calendar. The first of these rules states, if the Molad of Tishri, and that's the first day of the seventh month, Feast of Trumpets, if the Molad of Tishri occurs at or after noon of a day, the first day of Tishri on the calendar must be postponed to the next day. It's not that the Molad is all that important, but rather it's the appearance of the crescent of the moon that really counts. The rules of the calendar state that someone might theoretically observe the crescent as early as 6 hours after the conjunction, but not a moment earlier. Since there is no scriptural method for establishing the new moon, this rule would seem to make sense. Would you celebrate the Feast of Trumpets when over half the day is gone at the time of the new moon? The next day would provide a full day on which to celebrate this annual holy day. So that's pretty clear, right? I mean, you see it, the day's already started, you figure, okay, well, let's celebrate the next day. Because visually speaking, at least I can't, maybe you can't, I can't tell the difference. When there's a full moon, it looks full to me for several nights, doesn't it to you? So that's another difficulty. Some people say, well, the full moon was last night. No, I don't think it was quite full, I think it's the next night. Okay. That's some of the problems you run into, or could run into. The second rule forbids the first of Tishri falling on a Sunday, Wednesday, or Friday. If the first of Tishri were observed on a Sunday, now this you'll have to just take for granted, it's correct. If the first of Tishri were observed on a Sunday, then the first day of the feast would be on a Sunday, and also the last great day. Three out of the four fall holy days would be back-to-back with the Sabbath. The only holy days that can fall on Sunday are the first day of unleavened bread and Pentecost. If the Feast of Trumpets were on a Friday, there would be no preparation day for the weekly Sabbaths occurring during the time of the fall holy days. We find several references in the Bible indicating that the preparation for the Sabbath is very important to God. If the Feast of Trumpets were on a Wednesday, the Day of Atonement would occur on a Friday, which should be the preparation day for the weekly Sabbath. The command in Scripture for atonement forbids any food preparation. If the Feast of Trumpets were to be observed on Wednesday, there would also be an issue with the Passover, which would take place on Saturday night, a most difficult time. By postponing the first of Tishri from Wednesday, this scenario is prevented. In any given year, we find that only the last day of unleavened bread can fall on a Friday. The second rule of postponement, therefore, prevents the significant difficulties that would arise from back-to-back Sabbaths in the fall holy day season. Although back-to-back Sabbaths can occur in the spring, they do not create a significant hardship by virtue of taking place only once or twice in a two-month period. So that one's pretty simple, unless, you know, you can't, I don't think you can visualize this. We just have to take for granted, I guess that's true, you know, without looking at a calendar. Rules 3 and 4 regulate the length of year in the Hebrew calendar. The maximum length of a common year in the Hebrew calendar is 355 days. Without Rule 3, a common year might have 356 days. The minimum number of days an intercalary year can have is 382 days. If Rule 4 were not in effect, some leap years would have too few days. At this point, you can appreciate that we don't have to understand this, right? I'm not going to give you a quiz on this afterwards. Please explain the four rules of postponement, because I wouldn't be able to grade the papers, so you don't know if you're correct or not. Without these postponement rules, the Hebrew calendar would be in a perpetual state of confusion. Great difficulties would occur between the Sabbath and the holy days. The lengths of years would be irregular. Calendar reformers would be tempted to tamper with this calendar more often. But all this is avoided by four very simple and easily applied postponement rules. Easy for you to say, huh? Instead of the festivals being subordinate to the Hebrew calendar, the latter serves the holy days. Where are these postponements in the Bible? Just as there is no definition of the new moon, vernal equinox, etc., neither does the Bible list rules of postponement. Who authorized them? When were they created? No one really knows the answer to these questions. In the year AD 358, Hillel II released the rules for calendar calculation, which included the rules of postponement. Prior to this time, the whole subject was shrouded in mystery. No one knows when these rules were added to the calendar. Could they have been part of a calendar from the beginning? Possibly. Were they a part of the calendar during the days of Christ? We simply don't know. We do not know when the Jews began using a calculated calendar instead of simply relying on visual observation. Some speculate the calendar was in existence long before Christ. They base their idea on the fact that the months are called by Chaldean names. The Jews were in captivity in Babylon in 6th century B.C. Was there a calendar already in existence at that time, and did it contain the rules of postponement? The Bible simply doesn't tell us, and secular history is vague. There appears to be no dispute, at least none is recorded, regarding the calendar calculations during the time of Christ and the apostles. The use of an intercalary month in itself is a form of postponement. So there you have the simplest version, I guess you could read, of the rules of postponement. All right, in John chapter 7, interesting interesting point with regard to the postponements. This is a reference of starting in verse 1 of John 7 of Jesus Christ keeping a Feast of Tabernacles. Starting verse 1, John chapter 7, after these things, Jesus walked in Galilee, for he did not want to walk in Judea because the Jews sought to kill him. Now the Jews' Feast of Tabernacles was at hand. Notice it says the Jews' Feast of Tabernacles. Makes it clear it was a time that the Jewish nation was keeping the Feast of Tabernacles, following, of course, the Hebrew calendar. His brother said to him, "Depart from here and go into Judea so that your disciples also may see the works you're doing. For no one does anything in secret while he himself seeks to be known openly. If you do these things, show yourself to the world." For even his brothers did not believe him. Verse 6, then Jesus said to them, "My time is not yet come, but your time is always ready." And he's not talking about different calendar. He's just obviously talking about something very different than that. He says, "The world cannot hate you, but it hates me because I testify of it that its works are evil. You go up to this feast. I'm not yet going up to this feast, for my time is not yet fully come." And again, he's not saying this about the calendar. He's merely saying that he wanted to sneak up there later, rather, you know, so that he would avoid persecution. So when he had said these things to them, he remained in Galilee, but his brothers, when his brothers had gone up, then he also went up to the feast, not openly, but as it were in secret. So the point is that Jesus kept the feast on the same day that the Jews did. So that, I think, is a significant scriptural statement with regard to the calendar. All right, now I'm going to go to Acts 2 and verse 1. I'm going to ask you a question here. What would you say is the greatest miracle that took place on the day of Pentecost? Okay, I'm funning with you here, because I'm going to give you an answer you probably never heard before. It's in verse 1 of Acts chapter 2. When the day of Pentecost had fully come, they were all with one accord in one place. Is that true today? No. It was true for this point in time, because the church it was just beginning. How long was it before some people started disagreeing, going separate directions on the calendar and other doctrinal issues? You know, that's somewhat of a tongue-in-cheek statement, but in a way it's really true that that's one of the greatest miracles, that they actually were in agreement. They were in the same place at the same time. Not true today, that's for sure. The expression of one accord, it means pertaining to mutual consent or agreement with one mind, by common consent, unanimously. Pretty clear what it's talking about. Today, of course, there are many differing beliefs regarding when Pentecost and the other holy days should be observed, even among Sabbath keepers, even among former Worldwide Church of God members. You know, there are people who believe in a set day of Pentecost. I'm not going to say who, that's not the point, but the point is God's people today are not in one place in one accord. Unfortunately, Satan has really messed things up where that's concerned, but largely because of a lot of the calendar issues. So what's the solution to the dilemma? How can we determine who, what, and when is right? Okay? All right, let's take a step back and look at the bigger picture. I'm not going to give you the answer right away, because there are a lot of questions about the holy days when you look at it closely. Let's go back to Deuteronomy 16 and verse 16. Very familiar passage when we read every single holy day. There's something in the air that's so familiar, but I'll bet you never thought about this, but maybe you have, but you can probably see this with your eyes closed. Three times a year, all your male shall appear before the Lord your God in the place which he chooses, at the Feast of Unleavened Bread, Feast of Weeks, and Feast of Tabernacles. Question. How do we know the place that God chooses? Can you go up to the fairgrounds in Redmond and see God's name written up there somewhere? I've never seen it. How did the Israelites know where God placed his name? I'm just going to throw out these questions for you. Similar statement in Deuteronomy 14 in verse 23. Let me give you a lot more questions before I give you answers, okay? Because there's a common denominator here, you'll see. Deuteronomy 14 and verse 23 talks about using a second tithe, festival tithe, whichever you want to call it. And says in verse 23, you shall eat before the Lord your God in the place where he chooses to make his name abide. The tithe of your grain, your new wine, and your oil, and of your firstborn of your herds, your flocks, that you may learn to fear the Lord your God always. So there it says, the first reference we read in Deuteronomy 16 says the place which God chooses. This one says the place where he chooses to make his name abide. And like I said, you can't see God's name written up there anywhere, any other of our feast sites. And furthermore, how many of you are taking grain, wine, oil, and firstborn of your herds and flocks to feast? Nobody? Why not? You don't have any. So how do we apply that today? How do we determine what constitutes second tithe and how to compute that? It doesn't say anything about it. It says turn your stuff into money. That's all fine and good. But how exactly do you apply the principle involved with this command here? The Bible doesn't tell us. So let's get specific here. I won't throw any more questions at you. There's a lot more you could, but were these things left up to each individual Israelite to decide, you suppose? No. Why not?
There'd be too much disagreement.
Yeah, I'd be scattered all over the place. Well, I think God wants to meet here. No, I think he wants to meet over there. I don't know that the Bible says anywhere, but I presume someone, one person, a leadership position, probably Moses, was the one that God communicated to and said, I want you to keep the feast here. And so all the Israelites kept it there. Okay? What's that?
Same with Paul and them, Peter.
Yeah, well, that's the point. Is I think that's a very important precedent here with regard to these things with regard to the holy days, where God placed his name and other decisions that had to be made regarding keeping the feast. What about today? Oh, question, Fred?
I remember Mr. Armstrong way back saying when they decided to have the Feast of Tabernacles in Big Sandy, he said, and he used these words, he said, I did not walk out in the field and see a sign from heaven saying this is the place.
Right.
He said, but when you put all the circumstances together, when you looked at all the other possibilities, it had to be there. There was just no other way they could do it.
Yeah, that's true. And I don't at all question that. You know, whether you're talking about feast sites or where we meet for Sabbath services or any of those things. You know, God doesn't choose to do things that way, to just, you know, reveal in a dream to everybody or something like that. So,
how hard did it take us to find this place? And yet when we did it, it was the ideal place.
Yeah. Actually, you know what? This was actually the first property that this realtor presented. And I just rejected that out of hand. I thought, an office building? Are you kidding me? And after we looked at everything else and nothing was working out, then he says, well, there's a room up there and it's got a sink in. I thought, whoa, that's interesting. I better take a look at it. So, but yeah, so you see kind of by circumstances and so forth. But the point I'm getting at is this. Who decides? Who decides where we keep our feast sites? Anybody know? In United? Council makes the final decision. The person who does the legwork, he's got very short legs, but he does the legwork anyways, Charles Mollier, a good friend of ours. And he goes out, scopes out the things, kind of narrows it down, makes his recommendations to council, and they make the final decision. Okay? So we don't say, okay, where would you all like to have the feast this year? Now, you know, you can do this with regard to designated sites, but we don't say, well, you know, would you like to keep the feast in, name a city, Christmas Valley? Well, nobody would want to do there, but no, I mean, if you left up to each individual, we'd be scattered all over the place, right? So it's decided by someone in a position of leadership, and that means that we all keep the feast at least in the same place. In United, of course, there are a lot of different church organizations, and so, you know, I assume that they do it in a similar way as well. So, anyway, it's a situation where it's decided by someone there in authority. A similar situation regarding the Feast of Tabernacles is in verse 39 of Leviticus 23, 39 through 42, actually. Another one of these things that we kind of assume and, well, I think agree with, I would assume, but it says, on the 15th day of the seventh month, when you've gathered in the fruit of the land, you shall keep the feast of the Lord for 7 days. The first day shall be a Sabbath rest. Eighth day is Sabbath rest. And you shall take for yourselves the first day the fruit of beautiful trees, branches of palm trees, the boughs of leafy trees, and willows of the brook. And you shall rejoice before the Lord your God 7 days. Do we do that? No, we don't. Why?
We have a different culture now.
We have a different culture. But exactly. Is it different circumstances today? We wouldn't even be able to keep the feast because their regulations would prevent us from doing that. But who made that decision? I imagine Mr. Armstrong. I don't even know. I imagine Mr. Armstrong did way back there. He gleaned a principle. It says here in verse 42, you shall dwell in booths, which means temporary dwelling places, for 7 days. All who are native Israelites shall dwell in booths. So the decision was made, and again I assume by Mr. Armstrong, that since we have motels, tents, RVs, those are temporary dwelling places. So therefore, we glean the principle from this that we don't have to go out in the woods and cut down trees and stuff like that in order to have a temporary dwelling place. You know, they didn't have RVs back then. They had tents. Some people would say, well, you know, how come they didn't do that? Well, and there are some people who do have a booth that they put up. But I don't have anybody that lives in one. I mean, I've been over to families that invite several families over and have this big old house in Sun River or somewhere, and they got one of these Sukkots there, you know. And it's kind of like almost like a toy. It's full size and everything, but it's not big enough to live in. And, you know, that's fine if people want to do that, just to show this is what it is, what the Israelites did. But I don't know of anybody that goes out in the woods and cuts trees down and keeps a feast in them. Yeah, you would. You'd have a temporary dwelling in jail. That's right. You'd have a temporary feast, too. You'd probably be 1 day and you'd be in jail for the rest of the seven.
I worked with a Jewish gentleman a couple of years ago, and we were talking about the feast, and he said, they actually do. They go out and they build a teepee type thing.
Oh?
Yeah.
In the United States? Or what?
Yeah,
really?
In Bend.
In Bend?
Yes.
Whoa.
Yes.
How about that? Hmm. I don't know where the environmentalists are when they do that.
This is several years ago. I don't know.
Yeah, that's true. It's gotten more regulations and things. Anyway, my point here again is the same thing, is that we didn't make that decision. I mean, we all do this, but the decision was made by someone else. Again, presumably Mr. Armstrong. And we just all do that. And so we have unity and uniformity in the way we do things. And we have a list of places available at discount prices we encourage people to use. We don't force people to. If you can get a better deal somewhere else, you know, you should do that. But again, this is made by one individual, right? So if all these decisions, again, were left up to individual members, there would be chaos. All right, so what does this have to do with the calendar? What do you suppose I'm driving at? Somebody's got to decide which calendar to follow. If we all individually decide, we're not going to be together.
Chaos.
Yeah, chaos, exactly. And furthermore, most of us wouldn't know how to figure it. And we'd be at, wow, I don't know who to follow. You know, so-and-so's going, is keeping it this time, and someone else is keeping it that time, and you wouldn't know who to believe. Okay? Furthermore, let's look at another something here that I think validates that principle. What do you suppose the new moons were all about? Why were those kept? In ancient Israel, the key to holy day celebration was the new moons, because that was when each month began. How did the Israelites know? Well, let me share a quote with you, another one. This is the only one on, we have a study paper if you wish to read it, on the should Christians observe new moons here as well. Now, it says should, it doesn't mean you shouldn't. It just means should, in a sense, are we obligated, are we commanded to? And the answer, of course, is no. I think we've known that for a long time. There are people who do observe the new moons. That's fine. There's nothing wrong with keeping new moons. And those are things that Old Testament Israel observed. But let me share with you a quote here in terms of the significance and why the new moons were observed. In ancient Israel, the calculation of the calendar was entrusted to the Levitical priesthood. It was their responsibility to compute the beginning of each month and to make it known to the congregation of Israel. The declaration of the new moons was an essential part in Israel's calculation of the annual holidays. Authorities in Jerusalem continued to declare the new moons even after the Babylonian captivity. They based this declaration on both observation, that is, looking for the first crescent, and calculation. But who did it? It was the Levites. It wasn't every individual, say. It was designated person there. The key here isn't the method that was used, but the fact that the authorities declared to the Jews the first day of each month. Today, the calendar is fixed and there's no need for physical observation. The Hebrew calendar relies on the calculation of the Molad. These calculations for the Molad have been understood for many centuries by the astronomers. The use of witnesses during the Second Temple period, since there is no evidence of such in the Old Testament, appears to have been more of a formality, as shown by Maimonides. The actual duties had already been established by calculation. The key in understanding the calendar lies in the authority given to the Levites to declare the dates. In Leviticus 23, verses 2 and 4, we read of the responsibility to proclaim the festivals. Remember, we read that. You know, what we need to realize, the book of Leviticus was written to whom? To the Levites. We read it as if it's written to us. It's written for us. It was written to them. They were the ones that were to proclaim the holy days. And so they were the ones that determined when the new moon took place, which established then the dates for observing the holy days. All right? Designated individuals, not just every man for himself. To proclaim the festivals requires an established calendar. There have been changes and adjustments made to this calendar over the many centuries, but it's still preserved by the Jews and used to this day for the purpose of observing the annual festivals. So very simply, the new moons were a time when the trumpet was blown to announce to the whole nation, this is the new moon. You know, some of you, I know in my hometown, there was a factory there that every day at noon, a whistle went off. Why? So that the people in the factory knew it's time to quit for lunch. If you left up each individual, I could ask you right now, what time do you have? And I have how many different answers? You know? But if you have a whistle go off, then everyone knows, okay, it's quitting time. Beautiful. Works like a charm. That's the situation with regard to the new moons. They were the ones that the Levites were the ones that determined when the new moon was, and nobody had any questions in which day the holy days were, because it was determined by the Levites. So we today then, the point once again is that we have individuals in our organization who keep up with the calendar. It's been studied into, and we decided, you know what, we don't have to reinvent the wheel. The Hebrew calendar has been this way for who knows how long. We accept that. And that's the decision was made by, you know, the leadership of the church, dating way back to Mr. Armstrong. There's one person, I won't use the name here because I don't want to embarrass the person, but one person said, well, so-and-so that was had a group together that had some pretty far-out beliefs on different things, you know. And this person said, well, if so-and-so even agreed with that, that's got to tell you something. So, you know, by and large, most everybody agrees that. There are some people who disagree, but anyway, the point is, this is what the United Church of God accepts as being the right calendar. And so following that precedent hey, you know, we don't have to go out and figure it out for ourselves and decide maybe we want to use a different calendar, because the precedent is very clear that leadership is one that makes decisions of that kind. God's holy days are focused that we should have our times of worship and rehearsing and reviewing the basic truths of God's marvelous plan. That's our focus. God doesn't want us going off in different directions trying to figure out all these intricate things of the calendar. You know, longtime elder Hal Trabig, he's Dave and Ken Trabig's father. He died some years ago, but he was an elder down in San Antonio. He was a career CPA. He just made a statement one time in response to a technical question about tithing. He said, "I don't think God's called us to become spiritual accountants. Well, I don't think God has called us to become calendar experts either. I don't think God wants us to get off on that tangent. He wants us to emphasize the meaning of the holy days." You know, Jesus prayed that his disciples would be one as he and the Father are one. And I've said many times, I'll say it again, that anything that divides God's people is not good. Calendar issues certainly have divided God's people. And I don't think God is pleased by that. One reason is that some consider decisions regarding the calendar to be matters of individual choice, thereby putting a higher priority on chronological accuracy than on unity, which I think is a misplaced priority. You know, some claim that the Hebrew word moed implies that God makes an appointment with us on these days. If we show up on the wrong day, God won't be there. You ever heard that? So we better get the right day or God won't be there. What does that say about Pentecost? How many years we kept it on Monday? Well, God wasn't there. I don't buy that. There's no way to prove one way or the other, but I don't buy that. I think that attitude and priorities is a whole lot more important than accuracy. I don't mean to say we should be inaccurate, but there's no way to know for sure on this stuff. And I think it's a higher priority for God's people to be together and to focus on the priorities of the meaning of the holy days than it is to get off on a tangent and go up and, you know, study out and come to a different conclusion and alienate yourself from others of God's people. It just doesn't make sense to me. You know, that sounds plausible to say, well, God won't be there if it makes an appointment at the wrong time, or you're there at the wrong time. But let's put it this way. If you said to some, you called somebody and said, meet me at, maybe it's in a different time zone, meet me at three, I'll meet you at the airport at 3:00. And you don't say which time zone you're talking about, and they don't show up at the right time, you get to blame them for it? You didn't make it clear. It's not clear in the Bible. It doesn't make sense to me that God would do that way, but as some people claim. We need to be careful not to, in the words of Jesus Christ, strain at a gnat, swallow a camel. And I think you can do that with regard to calendars. You can get so wrapped up in details that nobody knows for sure that you actually overlook the more important things. Our time is far better spent learning more about the spiritual truths that we can glean from the holy days and festivals, and leave the calendar questions to the leadership of the church and those that they designate to determine such matters, just like we do other decisions of festival observance. And I assume that you're thankful that you don't have to make those decisions, study it out and prove it and learn it. I certainly am. Because, like I said, I was given that information in third-year Bible at Ambassador College. And believe me, it's very technical. I'm very, very thankful we don't have to figure that all out. So, anyway, that's not going to be a technical situation, I said, to cover. I didn't really get into technical stuff, but just the overall principle that how do we know? Just do what the leadership says, you know, with regard to keeping the feasts. There are people who maybe do have the ability, the knowledge to study into it and might have a conscience problem with that. If they want to keep it privately on different days, that's fine. You know, but I would hope that they would also be together with the larger group on the holy days. And I know people who do that, who do believe in a different calendar, but still assemble together on the times that we meet together for the sake of fellowship. And, you know, I applaud them for doing so rather than making an issue out of it, which is something that can divide God's people, which certainly is not what God wants.